Sawbones is a show about medical history, and nothing the hosts say should be taken as medical advice or opinion. It's for fun. Can't you just have fun for an hour and not try to diagnose your mystery boil? We think you've earned it. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy a moment of distraction from that weird growth. You're worth it.
All right. Song is about some books. One, two, three, four.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Sawbones!
Wow.
Yeah, I'm bringing my Michael Buffer slash Oprah Buffer energy to the show today. Well, it's a marital tour of misguided medicine, and I'm your co-host, Justin McElroy.
And I'm Sydney McElroy.
And what a delight it is to be back with you. I'm sorry we were absent last week.
It was my fault.
Sid was at the hospital, and things there are not great at hospitals. I don't know if you've heard about this.
It's rough.
It's rough out
it's
there,
rough,
folks.
Bud, yeah, we're busy. Mm. There aren't enough people to run hospitals.
Mm. Yeah.
We need more of them.
Yeah. So if you're
and at ours, there's a strike. So
yeah,
just lots going on.
If you ever wanted to be a doctor, there's never been a better time to just start doing that.
Come work with me and help me.
Get
help
on as
me.
An entry level doctor.
No, I think a lot of places across the country are in the same position. Things are really busy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people to take care of, and we're all doing our best.
That's
so
not
cut me some slack that I didn't get a podcast out last week is what I'm trying to say.
And I had other stuff, too. I was catching up on Doom Patrol, and we have both been struggling.
It's not. That's the same. It's all the same. It's fine. Justin, did you hear about a recent outbreak?
Well, that, hey partner, you're gonna have to be a bit more specific than that.
Not of COVID.
Oh no,
something other than COVID.
No, there's other stuff.
COVID is very important to talk about, and we do many episodes on that. But this is not about COVID this time. This is about a different illness, one that is a lot more rare, and we usually don't see cases of in the U.S. pretty much at all, and certainly not outbreaks like this. And when we do see cases, it tends to be like tied to people who traveled somewhere else and that's where they got it. So this is all kind of a weird, rare thing that unfortunately has happened. And that is that we have had an outbreak of cases of melioidosis.
I gotta admit, that's not one that I'm familiar with.
Every time I saw that word, I always wanted it to be melody something, and it's not that. And so it's hard, like, to look at it and make it go from my eyes to my brain to my mouth is always an effort. Are there words like that for you?
Mischief.
Mischief. Like,
I'm better at it now, but it used to be mischief every time I would try to say it. I also can't spell what restaurant. But other than that,
I always get restaurant wrong. And I also conscience and conscious.
And convenience. All those weird, like, what? You looked at me weird, like, huh? Convenience? That's
well,
an easy one.
It does seem like an easy one.
It's no easier than conscience.
But conscious. Conscience.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, those two. Anyway. And then people are like, it's con science. And I'm like, but you don't say it that way. It's so melioidosis is caused by a bacteria that is called Burkholderia pseudomallei. Is that easier to say?
Yeah.
It's usually seen in tropical or subtropical parts of the world, specifically places like Thailand or Northern Australia and some other places too. But like that's where you see the brunt of these cases. So it is strange to see it arising in the U.S. We don't typically see that here. How did that happen? Well, before I get into the whole history of it, the reason we're talking about it is that there were these aromatherapy sprays at Walmart.
Oh, no.
This is how this happened. Specifically, There are these Better Homes and Gardens room sprays, which are like infused with essential oils. And I believe they say and gemstones on them, which I think is weird just because I don't know how, like, do you grind them up?
Gemstones?
Yeah.
They advertise having gemstones in them?
But look at the bottles.
I mean,
look at Better Homes and Gardens room spray. I mean, you're going to get a bunch of stuff about melioidosis is all what right. you're going to get.
I'll look into this.
Anyway, so these were sold at Walmart stores in the U.S. from February to October of this year, specific Walmart stores. I guess not all Walmart stores.
Yeah, I guess you're going to chase them down on eBay now if you want.
There are different flavors. Specifically, like, they linked it to this lavender and chamomile one, but there were five different scents that this was linked to. And you can actually, if you are concerned, if you go to the cdc.gov/melioidosis/outbreak, they have, like, the 2021 multi-state outbreak of melioidosis and, like, where the cases are, and they have a list of all the Walmart stores that sold it and what flavors and all that. Mm-hmm. So you can, for the safety reason, please look at that. If you are concerned at all, if you have any of these aromatherapy sprays in your home, please check this.
Yes.
But anyway, so they were selling these sprays, and they found that specifically in Georgia, Kansas, Minnesota, and Texas, they found cases that were linked to these aromatherapy sprays, which is just, I mean, add it to the list of reasons why I personally am against aromatherapy.
They have sort of like gemstones at the bottom, if you can imagine. Like, it looks like an aquarium.
Are they like floating in the bottom of it?
Well, it's called, like, imagine like aquarium rocks.
Oh, I see them.
And you can get kind of the idea.
What do you get, like, the power of the gemstones when you spray it?
It's also less, it's less aromatherapy juice they have to put in. Rocks must be cheaper than the oil.
This is exactly, this is not just all about aromatherapy. Obviously, we've done episodes on that before. For the most part, unless you're talking about, like, relaxation, it doesn't work. It usually is touted as something that doesn't do harm. Like, what's the harm in a nice smell? Even if it's not really helping with anything, what's the harm in a nice smell? Well, other than things we've pointed out before, like asthma or allergies, or for me, I'm allergic to all smells. And mm-hmm. so, like, when you smell it in a room, you've made that room inhospitable to me, Sydney.
Which is the greatest crime, I think we can all agree.
But also, I guess, occasionally, this is a pretty random, rare thing. But
yeah.
This kind of thing happens.
Still not great, though.
No.
I mean,
And I'll get more into it, but let's go back to the history of this. What is this?
Yes.
What is this weird bacteria? Why did this happen? How did this happen? First of all, we need to talk about Dr. Alfred Whitmore.
Okay.
So he trained at Cambridge and in London.
Ooh.
And very fancy. And he joined the Indian Medical Service and was sent to work in Rangoon at a lab at Rangoon General Hospital. Okay. That is where his part in this narrative starts. Okay. So it's 1911 and he's working in this lab. And a lot of what he does, along with his assistant, C.S. Krishnaswamy, the two of them mainly do autopsies.
Oh.
So, and try to figure out, like, what happened and what.
Quiet.
Yeah, and describe different disease processes and stuff like that. So they are called to do an autopsy on a patient who had died recently for unknown reasons. Mm. Which, you know, you have to imagine in 1911 wasn't that uncommon.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't know very much yet.
Didn't know anything.
Well, we knew some things.
Yeah, okay, fair.
But not a lot of things. So it was a 40-year-old man who had come to the hospital. He had had fevers for like 7 days prior to coming in, which mm-hmm. is, he got sicker and sicker, finally came in. He was only in the hospital for about 3 days before he succumbed to the mystery illness. He also was noted to have some abscesses on his arms. When I say abscess, do you know what I'm talking about, what I'm referencing?
You know, you always say it. But it's hard to picture.
A lot of people,
sore, right? Like an open sore.
Well, not necessarily open. So a lot of people use the colloquial term a boil when they mean an abscess. They could be open, but oftentimes it's like the swollen, you know, hot, tender, red pocket of infection that is the abscess. Now, once you open it and drain it, you have an open wound there. But abscesses are commonly formed by things like staph bacteria, usually. And until you, what we call IND, incise and drain, incision and drainage procedure, until you actually like cut them open and drain them, they can be very hard to treat. Even now with antibiotics, very treatable, but you do need to open them and drain them. Whereas back then we didn't have antibiotics either. But this patient in particular had a lot of abscesses that they attributed to the fact that he was using injection morphine. So he was addicted to what it was in all the papers they call morphia, but morphine use.
Yeah.
So modern day, what we would use, what we would call heroin, basically. This is the precursor drugs. So he came to the hospital. He got sicker and sicker. Nobody knew what to do. And he succumbed to this. So they did this autopsy to try to figure out what happened. What was the cause of death? And they found that there was an infection in his lungs. And they were described as having a cheesy appearance.
Sorry.
Where's
the warning?
Caseating, is that better?
No. Well, yeah.
Okay. Anyway.
Except I don't know what it means.
Cheesy. So. They didn't recognize the pattern as anything that they had seen before, right? Like, it wasn't something. They had seen tuberculosis. They knew what that did to the lungs. They'd seen a lot of other pneumonias and things. And, like, it just didn't fit. It didn't look like cancer. They didn't know exactly what it was. They did. This was at the point where we knew how to, like, do certain staining techniques like Gram stains to, like, take bacteria, put them on a slide, look at them under a microscope, try to figure out what is this. You know, we knew enough at that point to look for that. And they found something that looked like Bacillus malleii, which was a known bacteria. That was a germ we already were aware of. Because it was responsible and is responsible still for something called glanders.
Glanders,
you may not have heard of unless you are like a large animal vet.
I'm not.
Or you
not anymore.
Like,
I had too many heartbreaks. Lost too many polar bears. Dang it, these guys are big.
Or if you have large animals. I don't mean like we had a really big cat. I mean like horses.
So, I mean, that's the dream, but. Not there yet.
Glanders is a disease of horses primarily. It has been found in humans, but it was a big problem for livestock. And so, you know, glanders is very well known outside of, I don't know, this room. But anyone who takes care of or owns large animals. But typically you would only see it in a human being if they had had close contact with animals. So it was weird because this guy was not, I mean, he was living in a city. He was not necessarily out where he would have a lot of contact with horses or something. And most recently he had been, you know, unfortunately living outside and using injection drugs. And so it just didn't fit. Like none of it, it didn't really make sense, but that was that's what the bacteria looked like. So, and on top of that, this guy had also been in jail until very recently. So how would you get a horse infection in jail?
Are you going to try
to answer this?
Take your horse to jail day. I know it used to be very common in this time period to be with the prisoners ride around on a horse or take pictures
of
a horse.
I'm pretty sure that wasn't ever a thing.
You should listen to Ear Hustle more. They talk about bring your horse to jail day a lot.
I don't think that happens. So – anyway, they weren't really sure, but they had this bacteria and they, you know, already sort of guessed like maybe whatever we're looking at caused the sickness. So they proceeded with Koch's postulates, meaning like we have an organism. We think it caused this person to die. So let's take it, grow it, stick it in something else, see if it gets sick, do an autopsy on it. And see if it looks the same. It was very. This is a classic scientific approach to figuring out if this organism is the cause of a disease. So that's what they did. They took some lung material, they put it on petri dishes. They had like luxurious growth. They said they had lots of growth of
luxurious
growth.
That reminds me of exquisite pain.
Exquisite pain growth. And luxurious growth. They took some of that. They injected it into a guinea pig. I'm sorry to all guinea pigs. I'm sorry to this guinea pig. I'm sorry to all those who love.
Sorry to Riley.
Sorry to Riley and your guinea pig. And then they In the original paper, because you can read, by the way, if you're interested, the entire paper is available online. It's 30-some pages.
Whoa.
Yeah, of his, of Whitmore's
Franklin,
account.
Franklin, clear my schedule.
I found it a very enjoyable read myself, but that's just...
You're saying I'm going to want to read it twice? Franklin, clear tomorrow's schedule, too. I'm reading a boring thing twice.
In the... Who's Franklin?
My assistant. You don't know Franklin?
You don't have an assistant.
He's the guy at the tiny desk outside the studio.
You don't have...
You didn't wonder what he did? He monitors my schedule.
There's nobody there.
That's so messed up right now that you don't even... It's so messed up that you don't even see him as a person who sits outside my office. And haven't you ever wondered when you come to talk to me why he's sitting out there? And you always say, Justin, are you wearing a pretend mustache and pretending to be your own assistant? And Franklin always says...
Oh, like, no. I didn't know you named yourself Franklin then.
No, that's my assistant. You're very confused.
When are you Carl Stinkums?
Carl Stinkums is... Okay. The person who puts together scavenger hunts for the girls in the style of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Pandy Pants.
That's Philip Pandy Pants. Uh-huh. Okay? They came up with that name. Philip Pandy Pants is the boss of the secret agents that go on the scavenger hunts.
Right.
The villain that is always trying to thwart them on the scavenger hunts is Carl Stinkums.
They hate Carl Stinkums.
Boy, they hate Carl Stinkums. He actually got edited out of our most recent scavenger hunt.
Because they upset. They got so upset over him.
They hate Carl Stinkums. He's not even that threatening. He usually turns out to be a good guy in the end. Almost always. It's really weird. They just don't like the drama, you know? So no, it's just Philip Pantypants.
They don't like all that conflict.
Sometimes they don't like Philip Pantypants, honestly, despite his cool hat.
Do they just not like you?
Maybe they just don't like me. I don't know.
They like you. They like you. They just like me better, but they like you. So they, okay.
Do your podcast.
They, in the original paper published in 1913, Whitmore writes, after they have given this guinea pig some of this luxurious growth of bacteria, the guinea pig got sick and died, and then they did an autopsy to try to figure out if it was the same thing. So, and he writes, to our disappointment, the guinea pig died within 36 hours without any obvious inflammation of the testicles.
That's rough.
I think taken as just a standalone sentence, it makes him look like a weird guy.
Yeah, fair. Yeah.
Why was he disappointed, you may wonder? Why was he so disappointed that this guinea pig's testicles were not inflamed? Well, apparently when you did this with glanders, testicular inflammation of the guinea pig was sort of a hallmark response.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't just his weird kink.
So if he had done that, he would have said, yeah, this probably, even though the bacteria didn't look exactly like glanders, it looked similar enough, and this disease process looked like glanders, so then we gotcha. But they didn't, this didn't confirm the diagnosis, so they felt like they were dealing with something new. So they proceeded to, like, what else can you do? You got one case, it looks this way, you gotta find more.
Gotta.
And this was the quest they set out on, and I'm gonna tell you all about what they found and what we know now, but first, let's go to the billing department.
Let's go. The medicines that escalate macabre for the mouth. We were going through our Christmas gift list over here at the McRoy household, and there were at least two folks this year that are getting Aura frames. Now, I can't tell you who because I don't want to spoil the surprise, but it is really hard to find gifts for people that you really care about and make it feel like personal, you know? But Aura is a really great way of doing that. It's a great digital photo frame. It is named the number one, actually, by Wirecutter, the strategist, Wired. We could go on. It's a really lovely gift to give to somebody, maybe even if they're not like super tech savvy. You can set this photo frame up ahead of time. And then once it's there in their home, if you are out and about and you capture a memory you want to share, you can use the Aura app to just send it like directly to that frame. So like you're making the memories and you're sharing the memories like within minutes. Can you imagine? That's a lovely gift for somebody that you care about. They're going to be able to keep up with your life. And hey, if you've gotten them one before, maybe in another room. Maybe they could have a themed room. You know, in this room, I only want pictures of Justin. what a room that would be. For a limited time, save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver mat frames named number one by Wirecutter by using promo code Sawbones at checkout. That's AuraFrames.com, promo code Sawbones. This deal is exclusive to listeners, and frames sell out fast, so order yours now to get in time for the holidays. Support the show by mentioning us at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. You know, it's tempting to say, I'm going to start on the big new thing. You know, when the new year comes, I'm going to get it all figured out. Here's what I want to tell you. There's never been a better time to start your dream than right this second. And there's never been a better way to start than with Squarespace. We've been telling you about Squarespace for years, and that's because it's simply the best way to make a website. I mean, there's no other way to put it than that, folks. People have been using Squarespace to make incredible professional-looking websites. And they look professional because the templates they're using, they are made by real web designers. So they're making, like, building blocks that are going to look great. You just bring your stuff, your images, your things you want to sell, any of that, and Squarespace is going to help you make a great platform for it. Head to squarespace.com/sawbones for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use offer code Sawbones to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hi, it's me, Dave Hill, from before. Here to tell you about my brand new show on Maximum Fun, the Dave Hill Good Time Hour, which combines my old Maximum Fun show, Dave Hill's Podcasting Incident, with my old radio show, The Goddamn Dave Hill Show, into one new futuristic program from the future. If you like delightful conversation with incredible guests, technical difficulties, and actual phone calls from real-life listeners, you've just hit a street called easy. I'm also joined by my incredible co-host, the boy criminal Chris Gersbeck. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, Dave. It's really great.
That's enough, Chris. And New Jersey chicken rancher Dez. Say hi, Dez.
Hey, Dave.
The Dave Hill Good Time Hour. Brand new episodes every Friday on Maximum Fun.
Plus, the show's not even an hour. It's 90 minutes.
Take that, stupid rules.
We nailed it.
So, Sydney, what did they find?
So, they did a lot more autopsies. First of all, they found out that whatever this is, it's bad. Because
unlike all those good diseases that kill you.
Well, because they weren't really getting to interview a lot of like living humans and ask them about it, or like recovered patients and find out what happened. They were just doing autopsies. So like that's one clue. This is bad because everybody who has it is dead. So that's a bad thing. So they started gathering more postmortem cases, and like word got around the hospital, like, hey, if you have any of these sorts of cases, like let the weird guys know.
Let the weird guy that feels guinea pig balls, please, you know
that guy. Basically, they did a lot of autopsies, and they figured out that they could find the bacteria in lots of different places. Definitely the lungs, as they had initially noted on the first autopsy, but also in the kidneys, the urine, in the skin, in the spleen, anywhere inside a guinea pig abdomen, because they continued to do these. I mean, it's a very rigorous scientific method. You do the autopsy, you localize the bacteria, you give the bacteria, you grow it, you give it to something else and see what happens. I know it's mean. I know. I know a lot of people are like, why do you keep doing? I know it's mean. It was how they figured things out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that. And in many ways, it did still seem somewhat similar to glanders, because glanders can have kind of a diverse clinical presentation. It doesn't always look the same, right? I think we've learned that in the last year and a half with COVID, that COVID can look different in different people.
Absolutely.
We're used to the idea that like, well, that virus causes these symptoms, that bacteria causes these symptoms. Well, not always. Some of them can look different in different people. And glanders are sort of like that. And this bacteria seems sort of like that. But this bacteria was motile, like it could move. Okay. And that was different. And the course just generally didn't fit. It just wasn't, yeah, there are parts of it that are similar to glanders, but it's definitely something new. The only time they did get the opportunity to sort of look at a living case, like the disease progression in a living human before they died of the disease, but it was retrospective. There was another doctor named Captain Knapp who was taking care of a guy, and he took pretty meticulous records as he tried to, like, you know, take care of the guy, and he did not get better. And then after he died, he reached out to Whitmore and was like, hey, I did an autopsy on this guy, and the things I found seem really similar to the things that you are finding. And also, I have all these meticulous case notes from his whole disease course. Would you be interested?
And also, my name is Captain Knapp, which I know sounds like a preschool book character, but I assure you, I'm a real adult should be taken seriously.
It's not NAP.
What?
It's not NAP.
Well, honey, it's an audio medium. If a character is not named Captain Knapp, clarify.
Captain Knapp.
Well, certainly that's not right either.
Well, it's probably pronounced Knapp.
Just crank out a quick Spelarooski.
K-N-A-P-P. Knapp. Knapp.
Knapp.
Knapp. Knapp.
It's not that either. His name is Captain Knapp.
Captain Knapp is pretty catchy,
and what makes
though.
Him sore is knowing the boys and girls are going to bed on time. His name's Captain Knapp. That's where he gets his superpowers from, the fact that he gets eight hours of sleep every night.
These notes, these meticulous notes, really helped because he had a picture of what it looks like before a person dies of it. And so he could talk about like the progression from initially the fevers. You get some like stomach symptoms, like maybe diarrhea, some general flu-like symptoms, you know, aches, pains, that kind of thing, chills. Mm-hmm. And then progression to the pulmonary infection and the skin lesions, which they had initially assumed were just because all of these patients they were seeing were also using injection morphine. Mm-hmm. And so they thought that the skin lesions were not part of it. But it seemed like there was a component that was that. As far as how they got it, even as they figured out, like, we got a new bacteria, it causes this disease that we can see present these different ways. As far as how they got it, he still wasn't sure.
And then he found someone in the office had a whole crate of Better Homes and Gardens aromatherapy.
In 1911.
Like sarsaparilla. It's sarsaparilla scented.
He thought at first.
And Victrola is the scent of Victrolas and sarsaparilla.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, back then, probably like misogyny and racism and.
Yeah, I'm so glad we got those stamped out.
Oh, that was a bummer.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It seemed to affect those who were addicted to morphine more, and there was an initial like, is this because it's, you know, communicable through a needle? Is that why, like, it's a needle stick thing? Or is it something to do with the fact that a lot of these patients also were unsheltered, were malnourished, you know, were generally, like, more vulnerable to infection? Was it an immunity issue? Was it a jail issue? A lot of them had been in jail. But, you know, it's sort of like confounders, right? Correlation does not equal causation.
Right.
A lot of these things, unfortunately, then and now, tend to run together. And also, the guinea pigs seemed to be able to get it from eating and drinking.
Hmm.
Like, it was communicable through the oral route. So is that something? That obviously, there were still a lot of questions. Now, this didn't stop him from naming it. So we got a new bacteria. It's not Bacillus malleii, mm-hmm. like we initially thought. So instead, we're going to call it Bacillus pseudomallei.
Oh.
You get it? Later, it was just, you know, and this is true, I think, in all, like, taxonomy, as you learn more about different organisms, mm-hmm. you restructure which groups they belong in. So it started as a bacillus, but it would later have its name changed to Burkholderia because it was more closely related to other types of bacteria. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that, because we understood where it fit, Burkholderia, if you're curious, is named for a plant pathologist, Walter Burkholder, who found that genus of bacteria.
Hmm.
So Burkholderia for him, and then pseudomallei because it's sort of like Glanders mallei, but it's not that. Even with that, though, it was also often called Whitmore's disease. Or Bacille de Whitmore.
Bacille de Whitmore.
Yeah.
That's a much more dramatic name.
It's interesting that he didn't name it for himself. A lot of people did back then.
I always wonder how you would feel about that, right? Like, for your name to become synonymous with a disease. I'm not sure I'd love that legacy. Although I get why people would like it. Just like, I'm not sure I'd be into it.
Really?
It's like a negative connotation, right? There's not a lot of diseases that make give you an 8-foot vertical leap. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of diseases that like give you 2.5 times the strength of a normal human. Most diseases are pretty bad.
Yeah, I mean, typically a disease is a bad thing to get, but like...
Why aren't there good diseases? I think about this a lot.
That could probably be a whole other episode. I could maybe make a case for things. But anyway, I don't know. Because you get it named after you because, like, you discovered it, or you were the first one to isolate it, or you were the first one to describe what it did.
I get it logically, but that also...
Or treat it.
That also requires... like a deep dive into history, right? Mm-hmm. To like figure that out. By and large, it's just going to be like.
Well, not really, because you don't assume that it's named for like the person who invented it. Like, I invented this bacteria. I made it.
Yeah, but you're it's also.
We wouldn't name it for an evil genius.
Yeah, but also like anytime anybody talks about your thing, it's going to be in the context of like, hey, I'm beating this. I beat McElroy's. I'm fighting McElroy's really hard. I lost my mom to McElroy's. Like, none of it's good. It's all bad.
All of that sounded
bad. I have to stay home. I have really bad McElroy's right now.
I'll be honest.
I've been on the toilet all day with these McElroy's.
If one of us was going to be able to explain the compulsion to name something after themselves, I would think, like, the white guy in the room would be able to explain that to me. Because that's what it all is. It's usually, like, a white guy who's like, I know 30 other people have already found this, but I'm going to publish it and call it me.
Well, I guess you really put me in my place. I hope you get
I'm
a case.
Joking.
Of
I don't know.
I hope you get a case of McElroy.
I don't know why Whitmore didn't want to name it after himself, or why other people do. I mean, obviously Burkholderia, Walter Burkholder, the plant pathologist, was all about it. So I don't know anything about Walter Burkholder other than this. So I don't know what his proclivities were. Eventually, Stanton and Fletcher published some papers about the disease to help, you know, because it's usually like a building. It's like a building block thing, right? Over time, we learn more about it. And they were the ones who first coined the term melioidosis, which was in reference to the Greek for a condition similar to a distemper of asses.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
Say again.
Calling back to glanders. A condition similar to a distemper of asses. As in, like, donkeys.
I gotcha.
You know. You get it.
I get it, because you said the word, and you wouldn't say that normally.
I like it. I love the scientific system of naming everything about, like, well, it's sort of like this. It's an entire naming system that, like, there's a seed somewhere where, like, there was the first thing that we named something, and then everything else is just named.
Spun off. It's like it's a spin-off. Like
yes. It's how much it's like or not like that original thing that we named that one time.
Yeah.
That's probably Greek, as far as I can tell. The presentation, as we would eventually come to understand it, like I said, it can vary. You can have skin presentations of the disease. They're different, and this is true now. There are different, like, ways you can get it. You can get, like, a skin thing where it's an abscess with swelling and pain and fever. You can get a blood infection. That's obviously worse, where you get fever, joint pain, respiratory problems, abdominal pain. You can get a lung infection, like we talked about. You can get a CNS, central nervous system infection, like the brain or meninges kind of thing. So there are lots of different ways, depending on exactly how you're exposed to it and how much of it gets into your body and where it goes, that it would present. Any kind of underlying disease does put you at risk. So it is, in a sense, like what we would think of as like an opportunistic kind of pathogen, meaning if it gets an opportunity.
Mm.
Have you heard that term?
Mm-hmm.
So if there's something that, you know, can suppress your immune system or makes you more likely to get a disease, its onset is usually 2 to 4 weeks from contact. Most commonly, it's inhaled. Or you come into contact with contaminated soil or water droplets and can inhale little bits of it. It generally is not passed from person to person. There was one rare case where somebody got it from, like, a tropical freshwater fish.
How on earth did they prove that?
And like I said, the one thing that Whitmore even knew back when they first figured all this out was that it seemed pretty bad, since all of the patients that he knew had it, he met on autopsy. He also, like I said, theorized this relationship to injecting morphine. But again, this is probably more related to underlying disease, opportunistic infections, unclean food or water sources, that kind of thing. And that is true to this day that, like, when we see cases of melioidosis now, underlying disease, it is more of an opportunistic thing, which is part of why it's more rare, mm-hmm. why you don't just see outbreaks affecting everybody all at once, right? Mm-hmm. Because, well, yes, you could get it if you're healthy. It's more likely that if you have some other health condition.
Got it.
That yeah, you would, that you know.
Yeah.
Now, instead of what he witnessed, now we see things like diabetes can put you at higher risk for contracting melioidosis, liver or kidney or lung disease, any kind of other immunosuppression, in addition to like malnutrition and stuff like that. We didn't, of course, have great meds for this when we first figured it all out. We didn't have antibiotics yet, right? Yeah. Like this was 1911 up to like 1913 as we were defining all this stuff. So we didn't have any antibiotics to treat it. It must have been a very frustrating time, by the way, to write like these 30-page papers defining a disease process and then at the end go, so good luck with that one.
Yeah.
I don't know what to tell you to do, but good luck with it.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like.
Sydney, you're reading this in 100 years. You spent all day reading this 30-page paper. I hope you can figure it out.
I hope somebody else figured it
Thanks
out.
Thanks for reading. I hope you appreciate all the great information you hear, Sid.
Anyway.
Thanks for reading my boring work.
Prior to 1989, which I was going to say, that's not that long ago. I don't know. Is it? It feels...
I lost all perspective.
The standard treatment was a three-drug combination of chloramphenicol, cotrimoxazole, and doxycycline. But even with that regimen, this is prior to 1989, this is what we would use. So like in the modern era, it was associated with a mortality rate of 80%.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Jeez.
Now, at that time is when we get ceftazidime introduced, which is a different antibiotic which worked a lot better.
Okay.
So now we have better medications to treat this, and the mortality rate is 40% in resource-limited settings and like 10% in resource-rich settings, which mainly has to do with like the degree of not just access to the right drugs, but like what sort of supportive care you can provide the patient while they're recovering from the disease, and how much more difficult that is in certain parts of the world than others. So it's still a big, bad deal. I mean, those numbers are still incredibly high, but we do have things that can treat it now, thank goodness, much more effectively than we did prior to 1989. It has been investigated as a bioterrorism weapon in the past.
Gross.
Yeah. Glanders apparently was used by the Germans in World War One. In World War One on Allied cows. I don't know that the cows knew that they were part of the Allied forces.
Yeah, you could tell. They had that air about them.
but they became part of the Allied forces, and then they were infected with glanders.
Maybe they're not Allied cows. Maybe they're cows that are allied with each other. Maybe they're just like, no. We just look out for one another as cows. We're not participating in your geopolitical squabbles.
Listen, I don't think there are any animals that are. You can fool yourself, but like, they're over us. Our species, the human race, they're done with us. We're just messing everything up. The cows are not your allies. They're each other's allies. They're planet Earth's allies. Yeah. And we need to get on board. Or the trees are going to wipe us out. Have you seen that movie?
The Happening.
The trees are going to wipe us out if you're not careful. There was also an outbreak linked to a panda in the Paris Zoo in the 70s that was highly publicized. And this is usually how you kind of see this, like these sort of like sporadic outbreaks. There are, like I said, specific parts of the world where it is still endemic, but it's not all over the world. We've had 4 cases in the U.S. linked to these sprays. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we won't have any more now that obviously...
In the grand scheme, that's still very limited, like in terms of the spread of, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm
not... When you think about how many of these are out there.
This is one of those things where it is really a neglected... It's not on the list of neglected tropical diseases, I do not believe. Like I was looking to see because it as I was reading more about it, it's not something that I have studied a lot because I've certainly never... you know, treated anyone for it. But as I was reading more about it, I do not believe it is actually listed as one of those, but it should be because it is a disease that impacts parts of the world that often do not get enough attention as to what their specific healthcare problems are, right? Like, right. They need it, it deserves more time and money and research efforts and all those things. But when you have these certain sorts of bugs that don't affect the U.S. or, you know, Europe and these places, like, you don't get as much time and attention and money, you know, turned towards them. And so it is rare that we would see it in the U.S. I don't think this is something you should be afraid of. I think that if you have these sprays, you should get rid of them. but this is not like an alarmist sort of thing. It's more just, what was this thing you read about in the news? Like I said, the places where they actually had the cases were in Georgia, Texas, Kansas, Minnesota. Two of those people unfortunately died of the condition. Oh. And like I said, we do have treatments now. It's still very tough to treat. You need 2 weeks of IV antibiotics, up to 8 in some cases, depending on where the infection is. And then 3 to 6 months follow-up of oral antibiotics after that. So, like, and that's sort of similar to, you could liken it to tuberculosis is something that we can treat, but it's hard and it takes multiple drugs for an extended period of time to treat it. Melioidosis is similar in that sense. But again, there's been that recall, so I would check if you do have the Better Homes and Gardens essential oil infused aromatherapy room spray with gemstones.
Or you have an aunt who you think definitely has that somewhere in her bathroom. Just go ahead and give her a quick buzz. Everybody's got that aunt. Right?
And it did. I guess I didn't answer that question. How did it get in the room spray?
How?
Well, it is often found in contaminated, like, it can just be in dirt and water.
It's on the rocks.
These were made, these sprays were made in parts of the world. The ingredients, I don't know where they were all put together. Everything's, I don't know how all that works. I'm not in that line. But the parts of it, at least, came from parts of the world where it can just live naturally in the soil or water. So something, whether it was the rocks in the bottom or something in the lavender, chamomile, or one of the other essential oils, whatever it was synthesized from, somewhere in there, it was contaminated with the bacteria.
This is why I keep saying you can't trust this natural stuff, Sydney. Rocks, oils, all this stuff from nature? No, thank you. Give me chemicals made in a factory. You know, pound it. Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you. I don't. Pounding it. I don't know. I didn't pound it. No, but it does. It does. I mean, we talk about this a lot on the show. The idea that something that is "quote unquote" natural is perceived as safe.
Yeah.
And that is not to say that we should all be afraid of room sprays, because this is a very rare, random occurrence that happened.
If you want Sydney to be able to relax in your room, maybe you should be afraid of room sprays.
They just, every single, any kind of scent, though, perfume, cologne, candles, all of them.
It's very sad.
Air fresheners. I can't do any of it.
We live in a scentless, sometimes I'll have a small candle in my office for just a little bit of scent.
Charlie asked me what my favorite scent was, and I said clean.
Not even clean, because like clean linens is like a scent. You're just like anti-scent. Anyway, thank you, Sydney, for that fascinating history. And thank you to you for listening. We very much appreciate it. You're the best. And like, just thanks. If you want to, we wrote a book. It's called The Sawbones Book. There's a paperback version with some new information about COVID. It's not like new information about COVID. Like, we haven't unearthed anything. But it's got new chapters in this book. So go check that out at anywhere fine books are sold.
Justin, I should note, if somebody does have this, I said get rid of it. You actually shouldn't throw it away or dispose of it in the trash.
What should you do?
If you do have this product, obviously don't use it. Yeah. Don't open it.
Yeah.
Double bag it in Ziploc bags.
Uh-huh.
And then put it in a cardboard box. This is really what they recommend.
Uh-huh.
And then return it to a Walmart store.
Okay.
And then wash all of your sheets or linens that may have been exposed to it, clothes or anything like that. Wipe anything down that it may have gotten on with, like, disinfectant. And then obviously seek medical care if you're sick. Right. But I should make that note that you shouldn't just throw it in the trash. There's a very specific way of return it to Walmart so they can, man.
And make sure you tell them, this is the bad poison room spray. Make sure you don't open this. Please.
Return it to Walmart so they can dispose of it properly is not a sentence I ever thought I would say. But
right.
That is.
Return to the hazmat specialists at Walmart.
At your local Walmart store.
Thank you again for listening. Thanks to taxpayers for the use of their song medicines as the intro and outro of our program. And thank you to you. We'll be back with you again next week. Until then, my name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And as always, don't drill a hole in your head.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.